Good morning. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Last time I did this, the sound didn't work very well. How are we doing today? Okay, I think that's the thank you for the help. How many ways are there to work with a wound, hurt, or hindrance in meditation practice? At least that's what I said in the blurb this week. So I'd like to do something different today. In the practice that I first learned, the goal was to let go of hindrances. And 99 times out of 100, I think that's still the best way to go. But today, I'm exploring a different possibility, the possibility of a flowering or blossoming. A hindrance. A hindrance could be any of the big three: greed, hate, delusion, anger or desire, fear or attachment, any of the 10 precepts. For those of you who know the story, the theme of my talk today re may remind you of the story of the night of the Buddha's enlightenment. On the night of his enlightenment, while the Buddha was sitting peacefully, the forces of Mara shot arrows at him to distract him from becoming enlightened. The Buddha used the power of meditation to turn their arrows into flowers. Arrows into flowers. How is this possible? I'm reminded of a phrase I heard on a recent podcast that I like a lot. It went like this: historically inaccurate, yet true. So the talk today, if it is at all useful, exists in the realm of imagination. And my experience is that the way that we learn new things from a new culture or a new tradition is we use all our old stories and metaphors in order to understand it. So you can see the challenge here. So I will start today by introducing five new stories or metaphors, and we'll see how we do. The first term is the title Kuge, a title of one part of Zen Master Dogen's Shobogenzo, translated as flowers in space, flowers in emptiness, and the Shasta Abbey translation is on the flowering of the unbounded, and equates this flowering with the blossoming of Kensho experience. Here's the basic premise. What we see in meditation as a hindrance or wound or hurt might be a portal to awakening. Maybe one of our hindrances has the power to turn itself and us inside out. What if the inside out of a dominant fear or attachment is the luminous love of the Buddhist ancestors? So that's where we're going. We're trying to go. As Zen Master Dogen put it in Kuge, delusions possess the means of ultimately cutting off their own activity. To which my teacher, Jiu Kennett, added in her talk on Kuge, hindrance is hindered by hindrance. The second Buddhist idea I want to introduce is that of the power of the dying thought, wish, or desire. The idea is that the dying thought has special potentiality, and that this special potentiality is its ability to be turned or flowered or blossomed when we're in the Bardo realm between physical death and rebirth. If we were Asian Buddhists and accepted the Buddhist notion of rebirth, then we might more easily accept the notion that we enter into this life with that dying thought, wish, desire, that hindrance with special potentiality written on our bodies. The third concept or story is about the Bodhisattva Manjusri. Manjusri is usually understood to be the bodhisattva of wisdom and often seen carrying a flaming sword and riding a powerful lion dog. Here's one traditional account of Manjushri, disguised as a beggar on the path. A particular mountain in northern China, the Five Terraced Mountain, is traditionally considered to be Manjushri's mountain. Pilgrims to this mountain might encounter Manjushri as a beggar to guide them and test them. Only after proceeding up the mountain might the pilgrims realize that the ragged, unwashed, homeless person they encountered on the trail was Manjushri in disguise. Depending on how they had treated such beggars, the pilgrims might be worthy of a vision of the Bodhisattva in his glorious form. In the external sense, this is a classic spiritual tale, reminding us that anyone we meet on the street might be Manjushri in disguise. But I suggest there is an internal reading of this story. What if we all carry a version of the beggar in the path within us? What if that dying thought, imprinted on our bodies at birth, is the beggar on our path, Manjushri in disguise? The next story is one I tell a lot, one of my favorites from when I was doing a lay term at Shasta Abbey. The dozen of us were a boisterous bunch, and we took to asking each teacher the same question at the end of our weekly class. We'd say, "Where does Zen practice go? What happens in the long term?" Maybe we were saying, "This is hard work. What's in it for me? What changes?" Towards the end of our term, we had a talk by one of Roshi Kennett's senior teachers, and we asked him the question. He said, "When a beginning student has a load of karma come up, he might say, 'Not this again. Let it go away.' While the mature student might rub her hands together and say, 'Oh, goody.'" Let's pause here for a minute. We have two quite different gestures here, the pushing away and the welcoming with open hands. For a long time, I used to focus on the end point, the accepting. But now I wonder if the essence of practice is not the end point, the acceptance, but that energetic shift, the practice of the turning gesture, where we go from this to this. What's the effort required to do that? Maybe that turning itself is the point. I ask now, might these two quite different reactions be two responses to meeting the internal beggar on the path? The next section I call Shasta Abbey Disturbing Sayings, Rayon's Version. you may know this from the scriptures, but there are a lot of references in Zen to inverted thinking or upside down thinking. It's one of the things that I've always loved about Zen and one of the things that attracted me to Zen in the first place. So when I was a novice monk at Shasta Abbey, I used to work with a few of Geo Kennett's sayings that I didn't completely understand or found troublesome, or were sometimes downright disturbing. Sometimes I'd say to myself, "Well, I'm uncomfortable with that, but I can see if I turned my thinking inside out or upside down, it might be true or it might be useful." Sometimes it would really hurt my head. So, I'm about to offer you these disturbing sayings to see if they disturb you too. Hopefully, one of them might be helpful in an upside-down way. So here's from Geo Kennett. "Where there is hurt, there is self." This is really the tough one, I think. "Where there is hurt, there is self. The bigger the hurt, the bigger the self involved. If you feel hurt, the hurt is in exact proportion to the amount of self involved. Almost by definition, the most painful thing is the most valuable. In my own experience working with these sayings, I ended up adding two more. the bigger the hurt, the more important it is to turn it around. And then sometimes, when it had been difficult for a month or two, I'd say to myself, why does it need to get so bad before I can turn it around? Why can't I turn it around sooner? Here's how I struggled to make sense of this. The bigger the hurt, the bigger the self, the closer to the core koan, the closer to that thought, wish, desire with special potentiality, the closer to the kuge, the frozen bud that flowers in emptiness. And somehow that frozen bud needs something from me. What would it be? Like I said, I both didn't understand it and I felt there was some deeper truth here. It was important for me to distinguish between the hurt event itself, something that happened during the day, a specific action at a particular moment, and the feeling residue of the hurt event. This feeling residue can and does attach itself to any number of people or events, repeating itself over and over again in our lives. We see this a lot in the movies, where the main character is triggered by something in the present moment, and then the movie flashes back to a scene from childhood. And you can see how these moments are being layered on top of one another. That feeling residue is the issue, not the triggering event, present or past. This talk is really an imaginative exercise, an exercise in what if. So let's do it now. What if the whole reason one of my hurts or wounds seems intense is because it has that special potentiality? Because it is actually the beggar in the path, Manjusri in disguise. Okay, that's my five stories or metaphors. Now let's use them as we return to Zen Master Gogen's kuge, flowering in emptiness. First, we are all praying for Dogen's kind of hindrance, not just any kind of hindrance, probably not a someone caught me off in traffic hindrance. We pray for a hindrance with special potentiality, one that will act as a portal to something larger than ourselves. In a sense, we want a good hindrance. This is a very big glass of water. One entry point to working with a good hindrance is the precepts. Maybe pick one or two you struggle with or would prefer to ignore. What is the energetic work needed to keep that 10th precept? How might you greet that thought, wish, desire to do other than keep that 10th precept? We'd like to imagine that we can dance with this 10th precept, but it is fine to be clumsy. You are turning the wheel of the Dharma when you do the energetic work you need to do to keep that 10th precept. The 10th precept can be a portal. There's at least one more possibility if Jiu Kennett is right and the dying thought or the core koan has something to do with saddened or confused love, with love gone wrong, then we might look at the classic hurts many of us experience when we are young. Perhaps the heartbreak of losing something or someone we love, or the pain of being hurt or abused by those who should care and support us. Again, let's distinguish here between the hurt event itself and the feeling residue. I'm not talking about a particular story, but about the intense feeling we've linked to the story that may have its origins somewhere else completely. The suggestion is that we come into this world with a basic affective code already in place. And then the events of our childhood land on this already existing code and trigger some parts and not others. One of those triggered residues might have special potentiality. It might be the beggar on the path, Manjusri in disguise. How do we beckon to and work with this hindrance, this kuge, this beggar on the path? For me, there is indeed a trick, a technique, a skill to either master or, for some of us, to stumble into. The challenge is to find a way to both be that feeling and to hold it in your hand. Find a way to hold the feeling, not too close and not too far away. On the physical therapist scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is intense pain, it's probably easiest if the feeling is about a 3 on that 10-point scale. If you are entering into the feeling at an intensity of 8 or 9, then it may well be too close. And if you're holding it far away from you in your hand, like a 1 out of 10, that might be too far away. And the feeling residue may not have the energy needed to fuel the turnaround. In the Buddhist text, seems entirely possible to do it at absolutely any stage. It's just more or less difficult. Not too close, not too far away, not 2, but not 1 either. It is an experiment, an oscillation of coming and going, in and out, working with the feeling. You have to find the right place for you. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Shunryu Suzuki talks about Zazen as learning how to cook. We put ourselves in the oven, he says. The oven is Zazen, and your Zazen container needs to be strong enough to allow the heat to increase and the cooking to take place. Keeping the precepts is what increases the heat and allows the cooking to take place. When we break that 10th precept, heat leaks out of our Zazen oven. Become the pressure cooker and that which is cooked. Or with ice and water, become both the sun doing the melting and the ice being melted. Or with a hen sitting on an egg, be both the hen doing the sitting and the egg being warm. What if meditation practice is not only about letting go of thoughts, but also about the tone or residence or quality of that space between thoughts? What if that space between thoughts actually holds our thoughts and feelings? Like a bowl of warm water holds ice cubes, and that water vibrates with a certain warmth and set of frequencies that can be altered or changed. Mind-to-mind transmission is sometimes described as the sympathetic resonance of two tuning forks. So I very much like the image of sound waves and frequencies. This takes me to the church bell metaphor. How church bells can help us understand Zen practice. It's a big leap, so stay with me if you can. Here's the background. Church bells resonate at many different frequencies that combine to create their unique sound, which is not just a single pitch. The size, shape, thickness, and metal type of a bell control these frequencies to produce different tones, maybe as many as 12. And each of these tones can be tuned by carving away different parts of the inside of the bell. Of the many different tones, the last one, called the hum tone of a bell, resonates at a frequency beyond human range and continues to exist and vibrate long after what we hear as the bell sound has faded. Like a dog whistle, the hum tone of a bell is there, resonating, but beyond our human range. Maybe love is like this. Maybe the love of the universe, the love of the Buddhas and ancestors, manifests itself over a range of tones and frequencies like a finely tuned church bell. And we humans operate in a very restricted range with our 1 or 2 tones of love. We might come to think that these 1 or 2 tones are the limit of love's richness, beauty, and total power. Maybe the purpose of spiritual practice is to grow our ability to receive, give, and live love, so our awareness and capacity can be expanded tenfold. 100-fold. We work to tune ourselves through keeping the precepts, through bowing, through offering ourselves up, through open-hearted meditation practice. The bowing, the offering up, and the open-heartedness are crucial because that last tone, the hum tone, is not ours to give, but we can allow it to move through us. Folks who work with bells have computer programs and stroboscopes available to help them do their tuning work. We have Kuge, the beggar in the path, to guide us. The beggar in the path is waiting to feel a distinct tone of love, a frequency or resonance that we have not yet learned to sound, to radiate, to emit. This love note she needs, this resonance, is beyond our initial range. The beggar on the path wants nothing more than to feel that love coming back to her so she can flower and blossom into Manjusri. She is patiently waiting and maybe even beckoning to us. For it is the whole purpose of that beggar in the path to teach us that tone, that hum tone we cannot at first hear, but strive to find in Zazen. When we sit down to meditate, we might ask ourselves, are we ready to meet that beggar in the path? Whether the flowering happens instantly like a bolt of lightning or slowly over years, the work of flowering that beggar in the path is always the same, always ongoing. It is this resonant toning, the work of bowing, open-heartedness, and keeping the precepts that unites practice and enlightenment. And whether we hear it or not, the hum tone and the love of the Buddhas and ancestors is calling to us all the time. It's there all the time.
If you're in the center, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. Please say your name before you offer your question and comments and hold the microphone close to your mouth so people on Zoom can hear you clearly. If you're on Zoom, you can either type your name or your question in the chat box and Tony will unmute you or read the question out for you.
Hi, I'm Dai Guy. Hi.
Hi.
So, you know, your church bell metaphor and like a spectrum of sound and much of it that's out of the range of detection, but that ability to detect more and more of that grows over time. Do you care to say anything about what it was like when you first went to Shasta Abbey in terms of what you could hear and when you started to hear more?
I think when I first went to the monastery, I was concerned about and thinking a lot about how simply to be in the present moment. And as I told my friends at that time, I thought that was the goal of Zen, was to get better and better at being in that present moment. And I guess in a sense, I still think that that's true, only I discovered that for me, the present moment had layers to it. And that even without the presence of thoughts, which I thought originally was the goal, to be in that space between thoughts, that space between thoughts had a quality to it as well. But I think I learned best by making lots of mistakes. Okay. And that's the great thing about being in a supportive community is that it's okay to make mistakes. And I actually remember one time when we were novices that the chief junior at the time brought us all together and gave us a lecture on the fact that we were all too afraid of making mistakes. We were living within ourselves too far. And basically not allowing that, in a sense, that beggar in the path to make herself known. that answer your question?
It's as good an answer as I need. Yeah, I think so. You know,
okay.
This interests me a great deal.
Hi, this is Chico. I think it's worth noting that this effort from here to here, we think somehow it's going to be dramatic and abrupt, but it's can be very gentle and almost unnoticed. And we just find ourselves in this place. Can you say anything about that?
Yes, I think there's merit to starting small. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to work on that energetic turn. Yeah, and I think that was part of my confusion at the beginning, which I think lasted for some decades. Was I thought I was looking for an endpoint, but the endpoint is that turning, that gesture, the gesture itself is the end point.
Hi, this is Genko. Thank you for your talk. I found many things there that have been helpful. One is that it kind of illuminates for me a process that I've been going through since I learned of the death of my son by suicide last summer. And it's been very quiet. And what I realize now is I had already lost him. I was not in connection with him. And so it was confusing a bit when he died. And what I found was I needed to really wrestle with feelings of guilt, you know, and I recognized all that. I was like, oh yeah, this is my old hindrances. And at some point, very quietly, very slowly, I came to recognize I need to go see my other son. Because I have not, I mean, we have a very loose connection, it's fine. And what I began to realize, I need a deeper connection with him. And I think it has something to do with that sense of the old not good enough, like it's somehow all my fault. And so maybe if I just sort of like, as you say, sort of withdraw within, maybe I'll be okay, I can protect myself. And what I'm realizing is that's not an answer. That is not an answer. So what I'm doing now, it's slow, it's gentle, as Jiko pointed out. It's very kind of, I'm doing it in little baby steps. And I am reaching out in a way that I have not done before. And so I see this as, I can recognize this in what you're talking about. And I thank you.
Thank you.
This is Guy. Thank you for your talk. I was thinking when you described the hum tone about the observation that when it bleeds, it leads, and you never see a story in the newspapers about the Boy Scout who helped the little old man or the little lady across the street. And I thought maybe that's kind of like the hum tone. In the Roeverse, we talk about the formless field of benefaction. Is that, you think, any kind of relationship between those?
Yeah, I don't know. The church bell metaphor was so rich for me, I got completely lost in it because there's a whole other layer to it that I really love, but I had to leave out because it was a bit much for me. Turns out that we mishear the sound. That what we think is the primary sound of a church bell is actually like a secondary sound, and the people who work with the bells have to factor in the fact that the human ear hears other than what is sounded. I found that absolutely fascinating. So I know maybe there's something to that. Well, there's certainly something to the power of negativity that maybe the power of that negativity is in its ability in a spiritual sense to be turned inside out. But there's no doubting the power of that negativity right up front.
Thank you. This is Gabe. I think at the beginning of your talk, you said maybe 99 times out of 100, the task is more to let go versus this other process you're describing of kind of loving or allowing to bloom. And just kind of curious about if you can say any more about that. What's the difference there, maybe?
Yeah, Gabe, thank you for asking that. I wrestled with how to put this, because there's no doubt that that the way I was taught, and certainly as a novice monk, was this letting go of thoughts, letting go of emotions. An emotion like anger flares up, and we don't add to it. We let it die down. So that's a big part of learning the practice to me. I think what that lives out, and I'm sure Buddhism has lots of words for this, but we have kind of collapsed them all into one, like karma. But it's like the difference between that that flash of anger when someone cuts you off driving down the street, which in a sense doesn't seem to be related to anything, and that recurring memory, that recurring feeling of whatever that is, of being abandoned or bullied, that seems to kind of hang around and return on any number of occasions over a long, long period of time. So I think when I was very new, I because everything was so new, I didn't see that. But as you've been at it for a while, I'm sure many of us have had the experience where we go, oh, there's that again. You know, that kind of recognition this is a theme I've seen before. Then that has, I think, a different quality to it.
Thanks.
Hi, this is Miss. The imagery, the beggar in the path in the story, resonates with me. I feel like, you know, living in a time and throughout history, really, where people don't have basic things that they need, food, shelter, clothing, and are asking for help, right? And, you know, I run into those folks, and I often don't really feel like I personally have a reason to say no. But I was also reading a book by Darling Cohen recently, and in essence, what I understood was she was talking about like having an identity as like a giver and kind of doing it as a compulsion, because that's who you are. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts around kind of how to identify like the difference between, you know, giving to the beggar in the path because you have an identity around it or a fixed view around it versus like it genuinely arising.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. Let me try something and see if it gets at part of your question. If not, please just ask again. I think there are times in my life when I have I've made a vow to do something, and I for at least a period of time commit myself to doing that thing. And what the vow does is it takes at least some of the energy out of the resistance. Like I've decided I'm going to do this, so I'm going to do it. I don't have to deal with the daily resistance anymore. Now I don't, could be like going to the gym or, you know, whatever, coming to morning zazen. But I think what I'm actually trying to get at in the talk is those smaller moments of turning around. So not the vow, but the day-to-day struggle of I have to work with this energy within me that is moving in a direction that I don't want to go. So I think that's more what I'm talking about. So if you're taking on an identity to be a giver, which I think is a wonderful thing, and you're seeing that as a vow, then I think that's great too, but it's not quite, I don't think, what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Thomas.
Could you repeat the last line of your talk? I think it was something about the love of the Buddhas. Did I hear that right?
That sounds like it's a good phrase, yeah.
Well, I love the phrase. I just want to make sure I heard it right.
Oh, yeah, I was talking about the hum tone. I like the hum tone because we don't hear it. We don't know it's there. And whether we hear it or not, the hum tone of the love of the Buddhas and ancestors is calling to us all the time. Mm. It's there all the time.
So when I was a Christian, we talked a lot, read a lot about love, the whole concept of love, our love for, and the Divine's love for us. I hear about that less in Buddhism. Can you just talk a little more about the love of the Buddhas and the ancestors?
Mm. Yeah. Well, I can make a very personal comment. I went to grad school. I got a degree in comparative religion, and one of the things we studied was that movement of Buddhism from India to China to Japan and then, you know, to the West, to the United States. And I think that as Buddhism moved from India to China to Japan, it changed. It kind of landed differently in those countries. And I think, in a sense, the essential message of Buddhist practice might have taken on a different flavor. And again, this is just me, but it is my opinion that as Buddhism lands in the United States, that message is going to be love. I think we have a lot of problems in our country. We have, I think, a nation of radical independence that has a tremendous problem with that affective gap between self and other. It's affective gap between self and other is almost a barrier in the United States in the way that it's not in many of those Asian countries. So I think that for me, as the spirit of Buddhism and Zen grows more in the United States, that I think it will take on more of that, you know, that flavor of love, that's the way it will move.
Sign me up.
Hi, my name is Julia. Thank you for your talk. I just wanted to carry on that note. I feel like I have encountered the beggar within myself. And, you know, sometimes hearing the beggar out takes a while, and there's stories connected to it. And I feel like I'm chasing things down. And I recently went to meet all of my extended relatives, and I learned like the stories of my parents and my parents' parents, and kind of found that some of those beggars that I was hearing out were like almost relatives of mine, and that there was a love that kind of arrived upon hearing like my parents' stories, my parents' parents' stories, even if like they weren't always good or reflective of characteristics I would want to have, that ended up factoring into like who those beggars were within myself. So I found that helpful. My question is, how long, like, if you are investigating or exploring, being curious about this this hindrance, how long do you hear it out for? Like, sometimes I feel sometimes it can go on and on.
Say again your question at the end.
Mm-hmm. How long do you hear the hindrance or the bigger out before you kind of decide, well, maybe this is something that I just let pass, versus, I don't know, just exploring it further and further, continuing to be curious about it.
Yeah. About a dozen years ago, maybe more than that now, 15 years ago, I started a period of individual and group therapy. Went on for maybe 5 years. I found it extremely valuable. And I also found that it didn't seem to have very much to do with my Buddhist practice at all. Like I'm not saying that quite right. There were insights that I gained in therapy about me and my family and my childhood and my relationships with others, that complemented the work I was doing in Zen practice, but they weren't the same as that. So I'm a great believer I'm a great believer in therapy. You know, if you want to do therapy, great. But I think where it gets difficult and challenging is that sometimes these things that come up in meditation, they're really interesting, you know, and you kind of want to kind of go down after them. That's why I made the point in my talk twice about the distinction between the feeling residue that that can attach itself to multiple events or people or circumstances, and that historical event, because I think that if you go the one way, you may miss that deeper resonance. So that's one thing. I think the second thing too, and I don't think I said this very well in the talk, I'm sure for people who are advanced in their practice that it's different, but for me, I don't know that it ever goes away. What I want to say about that is that it feels to me sometimes like I'm always carrying with me both the beggar in the path and Manjushri in disguise at the same time. So like those two things are always working, and I can choose to go one way or the other. And maybe that's the, at least for where I am right now, that's this notion of turning. I don't know, was that helpful? Does it?
Yes, thank you. It reminds me of another talk. I can't remember when it was, but there was a monk who like drank palm wine or something like that. Or rice wine, and that was the thing that they kept returning to, but that ended up being like a segue to something that they were like working through continuously. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jiyu, and I wanted to build off what Thomas was talking about with love and Buddhism, and tie in the hum of the bell, because for the last couple of years, I've been sitting with the Brahma Viharas, which for me seem like four ways of describing love in Buddhism, and whether it's the equanimity, the loving kindness, compassion, or sympathetic joy, when I find that I've hit a wall, a lot of times it's just about myself and could be sitting and bringing some equanimity or compassion to it. I feel like maybe that opens up the other tones of the bell. Maybe I'm pushing the metaphor too hard, but I'd invite any comment.
I like that part when I was researching the bell toning about how the folks who do that, they carve out little pieces of the inside of the bell. And depending on what needs toning, you carve out one part or another. And I thought, you know, I didn't go there in my talk, but there's a rich metaphor for Zen practice if ever I heard one, this internal work that we do to adjust that toning. So yeah, I think there's something to that. Yeah. Thank you. Maybe we'll make that in. Last time I walked away with this.